This is the Thanks for Sharing podcast, the podcast where we explore all things recovery, healing, and relationship.
Remember to subscribe and download episodes in the iTunes Store, the Google Play Store, or on the Podbean app.
You can find more Thanks for Sharing at www.thanksforsharingpodcast.com or on Facebook at facebook.com/healingpaths. That's paths with an S.
Hi, everyone. This is Thanks for Sharing podcast. I'm Jackie P.
And I'm John T.
Today on our podcast, we have a guest speaker, Jared S., and we're going to be talking with him about his story and the wake-up call that came to him and how life has been different, how the wake-up call shifted his life, and how life has been different for him since the wake-up call. So welcome, Jared.
Thanks for having me.
So I met Jared a little over a month ago, right? We met kind of the beginning of May, and it was kind of a, we were attending a group leadership intensive in Malibu together, and I had no idea who Jared was, but we met in kind of this weird circumstance in which we both knew a mutual person who had told us that we could, we were arriving in California at the same time, and we should share. You were renting a car, and so we could share the ride to the place, which is, it took about an hour to get there. But one of the rules for this group leadership that we were attending was that you couldn't use your real name, so we didn't know each other that way. You couldn't talk about where you were from, and you couldn't talk about what you did for work or really anything personal. And then we were just going to get in this car and ride together for an hour.
So did you guys
know? Yeah, it was pretty...
Did you guys have a good playlist or something then?
Actually, I don't think we had any music. No. It was very quiet.
It was.
A long car ride. We asked a few questions. We weren't too invasive, or we didn't. No. We tried not to break the rules, but we maybe broke one or two of them, but not right. Not too bad.
We had talked about all the shows that we were watching on Netflix.
Yes. So very surface level conversation, shows, movies, you know, what's going on in the world.
Nice.
I think we broke a rule and said where we were from. And it was interesting because I think you live in the town where my aunts and uncles live in Utah. So that was like right. A really quick connection. I was like, oh, wow, my family lives in Layton. So
yeah.
We had that in common really quick.
Yeah.
It was great.
Really interesting.
But it was an interesting, I mean, the group leadership was a really good experience, and it was, you really get to know people's stories quite mm-hmm. a bit there. So it was kind of a nice, nice way to get to know Jackie and, see her in action.
Yeah, we definitely got to know each other and, had some great experiences. It was something I was really grateful that I was able to attend.
Yeah, me too.
So let's talk a little bit about your story. You mentioned that, you know, your story started in Utah with some family that lived there, but talk a little bit about your story and kind of, I mean, we'll interject with maybe some questions or stuff, but talk a little bit about your story.
Yeah, sure. Actually, I was born in Utah, and I lived there until I was about 6 years old. And so kind of a big change moment for me was moving from Utah to Alaska, to a small village where my mom's from. So I'm an Inupiat tribe member. I guess a little bit about myself. I'm an Inupiat tribe member from Alaska. The tribe is in a town called Barrow. The proper village name is Utqiagvik in our language. My mom's family has been there for a long time. I'm the Brower family. My great-grandfather kind of set up a whaling trading post in the late 1800s there and built his family out there. And that was kind of the history of that town. But I'm a husband and father, so I have three kids mm-hmm. now. I'm married. My kids are older, 16, 14, and 11. So we're in the teenage nice. Years, moving to that direction. I'll send one off to college next year. But this pivotal moment came when I was about six, and we left Utah to go to this village called Barrow. And it was kind of like, for me, going to a different planet. There's no fast food. The roads are dirt. There are no flushing toilets. People speak a different language. It was just a really culturally different place to move to as a six-year-old and meet all these family members that I had never met before. So that was, it was a kind of an uprooting experience in that. So that's kind of a, as a young man, just moving there and getting to be plopped into this different environment. And I think, you know, it was just an interesting experience because I had really, it was one of those moments where you get there and you realize that you don't fit at all. Like you're, I don't fit in here. I don't know this place. I can't get my needs met. I don't know any people. And the whole entire time I lived there, that was kind of the struggle for me. And even so with the toilets, and I've shared this story a couple of times, but, I didn't know what the toilet looked like. It was called the honey bucket, and it's just like a bucket with a toilet seat on top of it. But I didn't know what it looked like. So I went to looking for a flush toilet, and someone said bucket, and my grandma had a pot on the floor, and I used the bathroom in her pot. And so immediately I was in trouble, like right off the plane, I'm in trouble for peeing in my grandmother's pot. So it was very disorienting
for
being a six-year-old. And actually, it was kind of right before my seventh birthday. There were a lot of cool things about it too. I had some uncles who took me out on their three wheelers, and you could just ride three wheelers and four wheelers pretty much anywhere you want at any time. Mm. So there were some neat experiences with that, but also just kind of disorienting moving through that. And the reason we moved there was because my grandmother had become very ill. She had Parkinson's disease, and my mom wanted to move to be close to her because they had said she wouldn't have much longer to live.
Okay.
She ended up living probably like 10 more years though. So
oh, wow. Was, yeah.
I got to spend a lot of time with her and get to know her well.
So how was your family setting when you moved there? Either to help you support like that really big life change, or that made it a little bit more difficult to make such a big life change?
Yeah, I think our house setting was pretty volatile when I was younger. So my parents they fought a lot. They were violent to one another. I remember this episode's of violence and me yelling at them to quit and being afraid. And just that was kind of our home life a lot. It was pretty volatile and moving up and down. And even when we moved there, my dad, he had a shift working job where he was 2 weeks on and 2 weeks off. And so he would fly out every 2 weeks to go to work and then come back home for 2 weeks. And so it was a big disruption that way because I didn't really even have my dad around. So I really felt like I was left to my own devices a lot, especially in that town, because you can do whatever you want. You can run around with all hours of the day. And in the summertime, it's 24 hours of daylight. So you might come home at 3 a.m. and not even realized it.
Yeah.
So it was very different. And I didn't really have the support structure for it as much as other families probably would have had.
So you had cousins and aunts and uncles in Barrow, right?
Yeah. I had 91 first cousins.
Oh, geez. I have
a very large family.
I have like 60 some odd, and I thought that was ridiculous. Like you talked about moving there and feeling like an outsider because you couldn't eat the food, you couldn't speak the language. Did you feel like an outsider among your 91 first cousins too?
That was one of the areas where I felt pretty accepted. My cousins I had met, some of them had come to Utah and visit us. And so I actually knew some of them going in. And so some of that was actually very welcoming within my family members, my aunts, uncles, cousins were always pretty nice and supportive. But there were other people in the town where I experienced quite a bit of, I would call, reverse racism, where, you know, you're not Inupiat enough, you can't eat the food. There's a big part of the culture around whaling. So all my uncles are whaling captains and they hunt whales. And that's a big part of the diet. And I couldn't eat that food. It didn't sit well with me. So I had an acquired it. So I would get scolded and made fun of and shamed for not being able to eat the food. And I picked up language over time, but not enough to be fluent. But that was another area where if you can speak the language, you get a lot of points moving forward with the elders and the locals. But I couldn't do that very well early on. So, yeah. And go ahead.
How did that impact you, kind of that, I mean, cousins are accepting, but there's also some pretty strong messages coming from the people that you're living with about how they are accepting or excluding you. How did that impact you?
I think the big impact was for me was I don't fit in, I don't belong. And on top of that, my home life was pretty volatile. And so just a lot of questions of kind of why, what's the point of this? Why am I here? You know, what does this mean for me? And you know, it didn't feel comfortable. Like, I just didn't feel comfortable in my own skin. I didn't have a grasp on my identity. And it was a struggle, I think, for a long time to figure that out.
Yeah, I've heard you.
Those messages I learned early on.
I've heard you share the message too, or the story too, about like relay races, or what was it that you would participate in and when?
Yeah, I think, and that's probably the one that sticks out in my mind the most, is we have 4th of July games every year. And those are coming up pretty soon, but there's races and they give prizes and there's a lot of that going on, and I would win races and I would win other things, and they didn't give it the prize to me. They'd give it to the kid who came after me. And my mom would go argue with them and they'd say, no, you didn't win.
Yeah.
Even though it was clear, it was easy to see. I mean, if you had a video camera,
yeah,
you could play it back, right? And so it was really, that was really hard on me. And there was a lot of fights. I'd get in fights with some of the kids. Not a lot of the kids, but there were a handful of kids that, you know, I was in fights with, you know.
So was there also a sense of, like, helplessness or powerlessness that you got living with that? Like, mom could even go argue with the officials or whoever was judging who won the race, but nothing really changed. Like, you couldn't really do anything to affect change there.
Yeah, I think I accepted in some ways, but in other ways, it just made me more mad. And I think my personal competitiveness inside of myself was saying I can make that better. I can figure out something. I can figure out a way to fit in. And so I think for me, it was more of a driver to, like, how do I learn to fit into this culture, into this system? But at the same time, inside of myself, just questioning, like, and telling myself I don't really belong here.
Yeah. And we talked about kind of having the theme of the show being your awakening. And as you're talking, I'm looking at pieces of my story and identifying the times where parts of me went to sleep or parts of me felt like they died. I'm wondering, as you talked about being this outsider at the same time that you had support from cousins, like, when you were that age and having those experiences, what parts of you do you feel like started going to sleep or kind of fading away?
I think I at that time I put to sleep my tribal connection and that culture, and being rich in that was painful, and so I didn't want to be any part of that. And that I put to rest, and it was a huge part of who I am and my life and my family and all of that. And so I started to be really angry at that culture, at my tribe, at the people who hurt me. And I put it to sleep. I buried it. Yeah. That's a good way to put it. Parts of me went to sleep.
Yeah.
And that was a part of my identity I really didn't accept, but it was still there.
So what parts of you that were awake did you have to strengthen or really pull from?
I think for me, it was sort of the survival part of me. I gotta stay alive. I have to be competent. I have to figure out how to fit in. I have to know how to be better than the people I'm around. That's kind of what it fed into. And I think for a long time, that was just what drove me and everything I did. It was like, just this need to like prove myself.
Mm. So talk about that, because I know like sports became a huge part of your life during that time period.
Yeah, and so we ended up a couple years out of, after that, we moved into the city of Anchorage out of Barrow, and I had sort of got some mastery around being a village kid. And started fitting in language-wise. I could eat a lot of the different foods, but still not the really traditional ones. I was still not really in tune with those. But right when that happened, we moved into the city, which mm-hmm. was another experience where I kind of picked up the accent. I kind of intersperse native words with English. Mm-hmm. And people, the kids there just were like, who is this guy? In a lot of ways. And so it was another sort of like rejection experience for me, like having to learn that, okay, now I have to put down what I've learned to figure out how to be successful in the village. Now I have to learn how to be successful here in Anchorage. And sports was like the biggest part of that for me. And I really dove into sports there. I'd say probably sports, if I didn't have that, I don't know where I would have been. I think I would have been off in drugs or doing other things. And so the sports kept me motivated, but I think they also were part of that survival instinct of I can do this and put all my time and energy into getting good at sports. And so I did football, basketball, baseball, and just all through my younger years of school and high school and even into college.
I've talked with a lot of people who, you know, sports kind of became this saving grace, or it really helped them through difficult times. And they'll talk too about like being on a team and how being on a team really made a difference. Was that impactful for you to be part of a team?
Yeah, it was a place to fit in. It was a place to belong. I had confidence and I was good at it. I was mm-hmm. really athletic. And so, you know, people wanted me on their team. They liked having me. And so it was one of those things where it was easy for me. So it was easy to fit in. Later on, even there were some wounds around that, you know, just at a certain level, there were politics and rejection and things like that happened, where it was frustrating, where sports also became another frustration point where, you know, people's mm-hmm. dads would put money into the program, and so they got to play a lot, and it would mm-hmm. take away from your time or other people's time who were really, really talented. So it was really difficult to watch some of that happen, and those were also some of the things that made me angry.
Yeah.
I think that's I hear that experience a lot from the people that I work with, that like, what was my life raft at one point? Now all of these foreign people came to live on and they took it over, and it was no longer just safe for me or just an escape for me. It really kind of felt contaminated.
Yeah. So it started to feel that way for me. And at the same time, I still had all this other stuff going on at home, and my parents were fighting and just my mom's alcoholism and things like that, and the violence and just things like that, where she'd had a temper. My mother had a very bad temper. And so she would lose it on you without a moment's notice. Where you sit in there, or you walk in late from somewhere and the remote control from the television is like flying at your head, or you know, you just never knew what you were going to get emotionally from her. A long time.
What messages do you think that you were learning from these different experiences, whether it was moving to Barrow, growing up in the family you were growing up with, playing in on different sports teams? What were some of the messages you were getting about yourself, about kind of that shaped your worldview, and then also just about relationships, whether they were conscious messages that you could actually formulate, or people were directly saying things, or things that you were just picking up, sensing, formulating opinions, beliefs about?
Yeah, I think a lot of those shaped my beliefs that I have to make it on my own. Sort of that was mm-hmm. one of the big things is I have to survive on my own. I have to make it on my own. No one's going to help me. Mm. If I don't do it myself, then it's not going to happen for me. And so I think all the people I kind of could count on in that I thought would support me ended up hurting me or wronging me at points in time. And I think those were just some of the messages, like, I'll have to make this work on my own somehow. I'll have to figure it out myself. Mm-hmm. And, it just led to not being able to ask anyone for help or when things were wrong. And I think saying my household and part of the worldview was my mom was very emotional and volatile and my dad was sort of checked out. So I had these two really extreme examples of like how to deal with emotions going on in my house. And so I had no clue sort of how to deal with my own. Mm-hmm. Even though for the most part, I wear my heart on my sleeve. And I think that's something that was different about me and my family. Because my grandma, when I was growing up, used to always call me a weirdo. And I couldn't kind of figure that out for a long time. Until I was at her funeral, and this is my dad's mother, and she always called me a weirdo all the time. And I think it was because I was a man who showed emotion, and every man in her life didn't. So I remember being at her funeral and being the only person, man, crying. And I was just lost it. And she was one of my favorite people, and I was just bawling. And no other man in the room were, or even shedding a tear. And so it was like this moment, like, oh, that's why she thought I was a weirdo.
Yeah.
But she meant that in a good way, I'm sure. Yeah. That was different. Well, because she always took care of me and loved me.
And her parting gift to you at her funeral was you realizing why she thought you were a weirdo. I mean, that's...
Yeah, exactly.
I can really relate to what you're saying about feeling, like getting that message that you have to do it alone and... how confusing that or conflictual that can be as you're going through the motions of kind of regular adulthood, like dating people, working on teams, having children. So you're immersed in these relationships, but the belief is still I'm alone. So like, how did that belief play out for you as you started a family, as you dated, as you had to interact with people, but still holding on to that? It's really up to me.
Yeah. Well, and I think my relationship with my mother sort of creeped in with my dating and the way I viewed that. I had some female bosses and I couldn't listen to them. Like if they gave me any criticism, I would immediately be defensive and get angry and, you know, push back and fight. And I think that kind of early in my career, I think that hurt me. And I think, you know, just it was because I didn't trust my mother. And I was translating that into like every woman I ever dealt with. Mm-hmm. And so it became this, being able to trust women, being able to know that they're going to be safe to be around. So that was really hard. And having to do it alone, I just never wanted to ask for help. I still have a hard time asking for help these days. But it's a lot better than it used to be. Mm-hmm. But just that whole idea of I have to be good enough on my own, I have to create my own sense of self-worth somehow.
Yeah.
And I just built up like a giant ego. It was pretty, I think, false. You know, it was a false idea of who I was and what I wanted to be. And so as I started growing into manhood and into raising a family and being married, it just manifested in me chasing my ego and my career and trying to be the best at that. And I think one of the things I share a lot is I remember just being at a conference and giving a talk and saying, I'm a family man, you know, giving this introduction of being a family man and like this little voice inside of me just said, you're never even home. How are you a family man? Mm-hmm. You're on the road all the time. You're at work all the time. That's not like, you're just lying. And it was just like a surreal moment of thinking, man, I'm not who I say I am. And so I think those things kind of pushed me in. And so I think, you know, we talk about the wake up call and that, but I sort of built this up, this big ego up, and then I pushed down on my pain and I put parts of myself to sleep. My emotions, I just started to put more and more of that to sleep and push down the pain and the anger more and more as I got older.
So I want to talk a little bit about, like, what are some of the consequences of pushing that down, building up this ego, pushing down the rest. But I want to go back. You were talking about this introduction you had at this conference and talking about what a family man you were, and this little voice calling you out in your head, telling you that you were a liar. What did you do with that voice then?
I kind of didn't really pay attention to it. It was a later realization.
So, like, how much later would you really give that voice an audience?
I think, so this was a time I was in grad school. I was really moving up in my career in the organization I was working for. And I was studying organization development. We were doing a lot of behavioral science. And we were sitting in these things called professional development labs with other groups of people. And we were just really kind of having to learn a lot about ourselves and our worldviews. And so I sort of started to crack open things and that I hadn't really been, that I've been suppressing for a long time, just about my emotions and the pain I had and mother issues and other family of origin stuff that came out for me. And sort of that stuff started to crack open. And I think I started, I mean, it was part of the process of like becoming more aware and becoming more awake. And I think sort of in the middle of that, I kind of lost it. Like I cracked open enough, but I didn't have any help. Like there was sort of help and coaching through the program I was in, but I needed something bigger help. And I didn't know what that was. And I sure didn't want to ask for it at the time. And so I sort of got into this battle within myself of trying to push things around, but trying to deal with them. And I think it became like a split personality in some senses, just this tension between pushing down that stuff and listening to the voice I knew was true, but not really paying attention to it as much as I should have. And so that was a really difficult time. And so I think what ended up happening was in my own home life, I had three children, and the makeup of my home at that time, when we added my third son, became just like the same as my own house growing up. Mm-hmm. So I had, my kids were almost similarly spaced. It was the same boy, girl, boy. And I almost went into autopilot of just enacting the worst parts of like my parents. So my mom was an alcoholic, so I started drinking a lot. My dad didn't show emotion, so I was stuffing all my emotion and being cold and distant. And so all of this was going on, and I was really, really just in this weird space. And I started to get a little more violent in my own home. And there was an episode where my wife called the cops on me. And I say she was very courageous in doing that, because I don't think a lot of women make that call. Mm-hmm. And she called the police, and I ended up in the jail cell that night. And it was my 30th birthday. Mm-hmm. So I woke up in prison on my 30th birthday. And I have, my grandmothers were very kind of faithful women, prayerful, and always telling me to read my Bible and be in prayer. And they were all gone. And my wife's grandmother was the same. So it was realizing that we sort of didn't have anyone praying for us. And so landing in there, that's kind of where I went. I just went into this space of prayer for like, I don't know how long it was, however long I was in there. But I was in a cell with a guy who was really twitchy and sort of kept slapping himself in the face. Another gentleman came into our cell and spent the night there, who had just kind of, he said that he killed his girlfriend and resuscitated her. And so it was just it was scary. Mm-hmm. It was a very scary moment. But I really had this time of prayer where I went into that mode and just spent time speaking to God and in that way for myself. And it was kind of really calming in a way. It was it was scary at the same time, but it was a moment where I sort of felt God just sort of stepping in and saying, everything's going to be okay. And I remember I couldn't get a hold of anybody. So it was also, there was this whole, I left a message for my dad to come bail me out. And I was just like, I'm going to be stuck in here. Mm. And, but he showed up the next morning and picked me up and brought me to his house. But I just remember just, that was kind of what got me through that, was just praying and kind of looking outside of myself for help.
What we talked about, some parts that started going to sleep, like what did you feel was waking up that night in the jail cell?
I think a lot of things started to wake up for me that night. And I think the biggest part was, I don't know, church, my wife and I, we'd been going to church. We've been practicing as Christians for a while, and we just hadn't, it was asleep. It was totally asleep for me. And I think that spiritual part of myself really woke up, and it was just, it was a sense of peace like I didn't really have before. I started to feel something a lot deeper in myself, and a connection to God that I hadn't felt before. And so I really kind of leaned into that a lot. And I just remember even after I had about 2 weeks where I think I had a restraining order. I couldn't see my wife and kids. And I just spent a lot of time in the mountain, in my scriptures and in prayer. And there's one particular instance on a really beautiful day where I just heard God say, I'm going to take care of you and get you through this. And just some really clear, like, if you do these things, then it will all work out. So I had like this really clear message and heard this. I mean, it felt audible to me, like an audible voice. And just being in that moment of quiet and in the wilderness and, you know, just allowing that voice to kind of come in and grasping onto it when I'd been ignoring it. And so that part, I went and did everything it said. There was like counseling and go to the doctor and do all these things that I needed to do. And so I went and I wanted to get as healthy as I could mentally, spiritually, physically. And so I went and sought out as many teachers as I could, and doctors. I went into counseling and life coaching. I spent a lot of time with one of my really great mentors, who's a pastor, who really helped me. And I just started doing a lot of work to get clear about who I was. And it was fun, like one of the first times I kind of just, all that negativity and pain, I was able to sort of just start to own it and put names to it and move it. And that was really powerful.
Yeah, I think that's such a hard thing to do, that ownership piece. And yet oftentimes when we really start to own what it was that we did or that we are doing or that we have felt, there's something liberating, there's something transforming about that when we're able to own our part.
And I think it's so counterintuitive, because we've been spending so much time and energy like trying to get those painful things to go away and to not have such a voice. To open the door and let them in and accept them really lets us do some of that moving and changing you talked about, Jared.
Yeah, and it was transformative, and I think I did a lot of different therapies and counseling and spent a lot of time in men's groups, and I just was doing everything that I could to sort of get healed. And I think, you know, that healing journey, but I just felt like it was like a big suitcase I was carrying around of negative things in my life that I just said weren't part of me. And then it was like almost I'm just like picking up that suitcase and starting to unpack it. You know, here's your mom issues. Here's family of origin stuff. Here's all the things that hurt me, and just being able to deal with them in a way and put a name to it in a way that I finally started to feel comfortable. And I really did feel I felt transformed. And I mean, I think they talk about a lot of religions, they talk about this rebirthing process, and it really was kind of for me like being born again and feeling like I've got something back that I lost, which was myself.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, right? So I was finally able to sit there and be like, this is who I am, good, bad, or otherwise, and I can work through these things and deal with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It doesn't have to be negative. And I think, you know, I took that. It didn't take long to start moving in a better direction, which was, for me, interesting. I felt like I quit my old self, like cold turkey.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked about this in other talks I've given, but when I woke up the next day in that prison cell and I was leaving, only thing I had left was my job and my career. And that was the only thing I didn't care about anymore. I don't want that. And that's all I have left. It was like, your joke's on you.
Right.
Still have your career. It's like, how did I not lose my job going through this? That's what I was wondering. But it was like, wow, that's it. You know, I can go to work still. And I wanted my family life better. I wanted to have a better relation with my wife and the people around me. And all of that mattered was I had nothing to do with chasing a career, building up this ego or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that reminds me of one of my favorite thoughts from the book Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis. This senior devil is talking to this junior devil on how to tempt this guy. And the junior devil says to the senior devil, this guy's considering giving himself to God. So what do I do about that? And the senior devil says, you need to convince him that he's going to lose himself when he gives himself to God, because the truth is when he gives himself to God, God's going to take him and mold him and shape him. And he's going to give him back to himself, even more himself than he was before, but you can't let mm-hmm. him see that. So I'm wondering, in that awakening and, you know, your spirituality and your religion was a big part of that, like, what parts came back even stronger than they were before, or more Jared than they were before?
I think everything kind of got better. So, I mean, and there was a lot of work with it, but I think my spirituality, like just being able to get centered and meditate and get peace kind of in any situation. It was like just a strange sensation that I'd never really felt before, that I really grabbed onto. So, and that felt really liberating. Like, and it was just, I can center myself in this moment and feel comfortable and peaceful and joy, even though whatever is going on around me is kind of messy or not working. And I think that's a big part of who I am, just as a person. Like, I get a lot of feedback. You're so calming, and you help us move through things even when we're having a hard time. And so in my work as a consultant, it's a lot of feedback that I get about myself. And I think that sense of just trying to be excellent in all my work and bring that to everything I do, it still was there. But I think it got better. Like, it got 10 times better. I was way more effective in all the work that I did, even when I went back to the office, and I was able to build teams a lot better, and I was bringing people in. And it even got to the point in my office at the time where all the kind of young people would come into me like to get mentored and advice. And, you know, it was an attractiveness about the change I had went through. I feel like that brought people to me. So I felt like other people were sensing that, that I've kind of gone through this spiritual awakening and been able to be more alive and more effective and better. And so they wanted to know what that was. And so that was really liberating and fun as well.
I think it's an interesting irony that when we start to accept that we don't have to be perfect, how we get better at what we're doing. When we start to say, okay, I don't have to be the best at everything, we start to be better at things that we had tried so hard to be better at.
Yeah. And so all the doors started to open. It was just interesting that way. Yeah. And you sort of let go of that perfection. And I had a mentor who said once, he's like, you got to quit trying to be perfect, because that's a sin, because only God is perfect.
Mm.
And the old Jewish guy named Peter Block, and he does a lot of consulting, but that was what he said, trying to be perfect is a sin, and so it won't work out ever, because there's only one that's perfect. And so that was really, really an interesting statement he made. And so, and that was kind of around the same time when I heard him say that. But yeah, when you lose that, and it just frees you up to be more creative and more, you know, you can be okay with good enough.
Yeah.
And it gets better.
Yeah. So you said that is something that you've been told a lot about yourself, is that you're calm and that you're a calming presence. That's something that I would agree that I noticed in the week that we spent together at GLI. Is that something you think that you always knew about yourself, and then you just got to know it differently, or was that new information about yourself?
I think it was, I think it was there, but I used it differently. And I think there's another part of my story where I lost my voice because of my relationship with my dad. When I was young, I talked very quiet. I'm soft-spoken. I never really had this voice that projected a lot. And so when I talked to my dad when I was young and he couldn't hear me, he'd just tell me to shut up. And so after a time of doing that over and over again, I kind of just learned not to talk anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so even in my work life, you know, I think it came across as being calm, but it was just, I was afraid to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And so I learned how to stay calm in that, but actually interject, you know, what I was thinking or ideas or be part of the conversation in a different way. And the calmness still came through. And I think before it was more of a hiding calmness than it was later on. But that was something I really had to work on a lot.
It's really kind of that, I think, reclaiming that quietness. Before it meant, shut up, I don't want to hear you. And now it means like you're kind of going within to figure things out and get centered in your perspective. And then you can come out strong and come out direct.
Yeah, exactly. And so it just sort of shifted it, over time. It has shifted. But I feel like I've always, I don't know if it was a survival instinct or a technique, but it was just how I, even growing up when my parents were fighting, or I'd always try to stop them and I'd always try to stay calm and not blow up like they were blowing up. And it was just kind of a way I dealt with things, I guess. And maybe it was how built into my DNA, but it might have been environmental.
Yeah.
You know,
we talk sometimes with clients about how we all have our strengths, and during difficult times, we'll maybe overuse those strengths, or sometimes we underuse the strengths, but if we overuse the strength, sometimes it can work against us. Mm-hmm. And when we learn to reclaim that strength with the balance and help that it has for us, it actually, again, becomes a strength, and we learn how to use it with balance. And so that made me think of that when you were saying, I had to use that calmness when my parents were fighting. But, you know, it seems like when we're using that strength out of survival or to try to manage this chaos that we really don't have a lot of power over, that calmness can sometimes work against us, or we don't really understand our own strength.
Yeah, definitely. I think it became a pattern. And when it becomes a pattern, you're not aware of it and how you use it. And, you know, I think all of those things, all the strengths we're given, if we make them a pattern and a habit and we're not aware of how we're using those tools, then they definitely work against us. Or if we over-rely on them to get our needs met or to feel comfortable. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the other piece, is like, after going through so much and learning so much and getting so much help, I think I learned to kind of, there was a comfort, like even just being able to be comfortable going into a really uncomfortable situation and knowing that it was going to bring stuff up for me, but knowing that I can handle that and work through it, and that would make me better.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of a discipline I think I had to learn. It was just kind of making myself uncomfortable on purpose to learn to have a comfort level with that so that I could be and put it into practice to grow and change and get better. Because a lot of the things and conversations and therapy I did was not comfortable at all. So it makes you realize, like, okay. And then how do you show up and begin to think about interpersonally and socially, how do I show up and how do people perceive me and what impact am I having in these situations? And that, that to me has shifted a lot, because I used to not really care. It was more of like everyone's against me mindset. Mm-hmm. But once I was able to drop that, it was more of, okay, I can show up here and I can put out who I am and not be compartmentalized.
Yeah.
So I'm not business Jared and I'm not home Jared anymore. I'm just Jared. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of, you know, these two personas that I took around with me. Now there's was just one.
Well, I've had this question kind of forming in my mind since you said that one of the things that went to sleep was your connection with your tribe. And I'm wondering, as you awoke, like what did you get to reclaim with your tribe, and what role did your tribe play in your awakening?
Yeah, it was, so I worked for my tribe's company that we owned. And when my grandmother passed away, well, let's say as a kid, I said I was never going to go back to my village ever again. Mm-hmm. And I had been pretty firm about that. And I ended up back there when my mom's mother passed away. So we went for her funeral and I took my wife out, and, it was kind of the first time I had been back, and this was earlier, but it was like a moment where I felt like this sense of, this is kind of like a home, like I feel home here. Mm-hmm. And I think as I kind of got more awake and sort of came to grips with that piece of my identity and all the culture and the tribe just kind of became really beautiful to me. So it just became this thing of, really, I need to protect this. It's very sacred. It's beautiful. There's a lot of really wonderful people working for our tribe, doing things to make society better and the world better. And once I did that, I started my own consulting practice. And basically the whole entire mission of that was to help my tribe better at anything they wanted to do organizationally, community-wise. And that's been the focus of my work for the last 5 years. And I think if I hadn't been able to sort of accept those things that hurt me and transform them into beautiful things and be able to accept my identity as an Inupiat tribe member, I wouldn't be able to have had this opportunity. And I think my work has really been a calling for me. So that's what shifted for me. So I get to do a ton of really meaningful, great work with my tribe members all around Alaska. So it's been an amazing experience that way. And that part of me really, I think, transformed a lot. It just changed and became like a really great opportunity and something to embrace.
Yeah, I think that's always a surreal moment when you feel your calling and you realize that you're being called back into the fire, but it's not like I'm going in to get burned again. It's you get to go in and be part of healing of that, what's the word I'm looking for? Healing that situation that hurt you so much.
Yeah. And it really has been part of the healing journey. And, being able to take my story around and talk about my identity struggles and how many younger folks I identify with that, and you know, helping them learn that you can accept it, you can move through it, and you have so many strengths to offer for your tribe and your people. And however that shifts for us socially and culturally over time, don't give up on that and who you are. And I think there's a lot of collective pain there, just mm-hmm. in terms of the wrongs that have been done and boarding school days and having the language beat out of people and things like that. You know, your culture is not good enough. Your tribe, the way your tribe has been, is not good enough. And so I think that's the story they've been told a lot, which is great because as a consultant who is part of the tribe, we've brought in lots of outside consultants to help us with business. And that's always the story they get, you know, you're not good enough. Here's my way is better. Mm-hmm. But as a consultant walking in as a tribal member and saying our story is great and we have a lot to offer and we can build things on our own, has been a really, really cool healing experience as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm listening to your story and this last little piece that we're talking about, it reminds me, and I've heard this story with a lot of different people. It's a similar, like the details may be different, but it's a similar story where kind of what started for you in this jail cell, this spiritual awakening, this experience with God or a higher power, that started in the jail cell and took its own course, but eventually it led back to you connecting with the sacred piece inside of you and you kind of finding this spirituality that was there inside of you all along. But you had to start by connecting with this, this piece outside of you and in order to come back to you.
Yeah.
This higher power that was outside of you that led you ultimately back to the sacred within you.
Yeah. And I, part of me, sometimes I tell it like, it was like I was sacrificing parts of myself for things that didn't matter. And so when I shuffled those away or when I sacrificed a part of myself or gave it away, to things that were not helpful or good, I lost them and sort of just regaining those bits of myself and, just sort of being able to own my own 2 feet of the ground and be myself mm-hmm. in this space and be able to find that peace inside of me wherever I was still very powerful and still keeps me grounded today, I think. And so, I mean, that for me was very transformative. But, you know, I always have to remind myself not to go too much inside or not to know too much. There, for me, relying on God and being able to have those spiritual practices in place has helped ground me and keep me humble as well.
Right. There's also that story that I couldn't find this greatness within me without going outside of myself to something higher. So I can't just totally say, I got it. Now that I came back to myself, I'm good. And I don't need anything else. It's this combination of what's within me combined with something higher.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I'm not good at this all the time, but for a while I had a really good routine and I just closed my office door and I had in my office and I had a big window that looked out and it was a really beautiful view. And I would just sort of sit there and pray and meditate for, you know, 20 or 30 minutes. A couple times a day. And it was a really grounding practice. And I try to do that quite a bit now, but it's more of not talking to myself. It's more of a conversation with God about, you know, where should I go? What should I be focused on? And, you know, just trying to hear that quiet voice, you know, and feel taken care of in a way.
Yeah.
So alone.
Tell us a little bit about, you talked about how people at work saw the transformation, were attracted to you, would come to you as a mentor. How did things change in your marriage, or how did things change in with your relationship with your kids or with your parents?
Yeah. So in my marriage, my wife and I, within 2 weeks, we sort of had hashed everything out and decided we were going to make it work. And so we did a lot of counseling together and we started to work on those things together and sort of kind of went through this process of healing I mean, we both, and I'm super thankful because she sort of at the same time, you know, like I think she blamed me a lot, but all of a sudden she started to take ownership as well. Like, and it was just really like, and I didn't expect it, I guess. And so she started to take ownership for her pain and her hurts and her life story and all of these things. And so we went through that process together and our marriage got really strong. And we made it a priority. I think that's what it was. We were going to, you know, go all in for each other to make it better. And so we did that work together and on our own. And so both of us kind of went through this transformative process. And our marriage, we fought a lot early on, and it's just gotten so much better. We're on the same page around parenting and life and trying to stay connected that way. I think with my kids, I think they started to trust me more. They started to talk to me and open up more. And it was, I think the neatest story was I had my daughter and we were at the grocery store and I was holding her hand and walking through the aisle. And she looked at me and said, "Dad, I used to want to run away." Mm-hmm. And, but I never wanted to tell you that. Mm-hmm. And like her being able to just say that to me was like really, she was like 6 or 7 years old. And I just remember thinking, oh my goodness, like she trusts me enough to, you know, open up to me and this thing she's been holding on to, she's letting go of.
Wow.
Yeah. So I think those relationships changed a lot. You know, they got a lot better. And the kids, I mean, we are healthier. I think the fighting started and there wasn't that untrusting environment anymore for it to feel safe. And then after a while, my mom went through some really hard times. And so we had kind of cut her out of our life just because it was toxic and hard. And she had a husband I was really kind of creeped out by. And she ended up divorcing him with a restraining order and things like that. But she started to, like during the time where we weren't saying it, once she went through a lot of painful things, she actually went and got a lot of help. And I think she had known we were getting a lot of help. And I think I was having coffee with a really good friend of mine, and we hadn't really spoken to my mom in about 2 years. And I had coffee with, he was a really good friend of mine. We had coffee like every Wednesday for a long time. And he goes, "Dude, I baptized your mom yesterday." And I was like, "You didn't?" "I've had your mom in my baptism class for like a year and I didn't even know it was your mom." What? So he told me that, and he told me like all of the change that she went through. And it was just like, it was really interesting that, and I had no idea because I hadn't talked to her. And he didn't know that she was my mother. And it was just like, it was really neat. So I kind of reached out to her and went and saw her and talked to her just to see, you know, what was going on with her. And she had completely done a 180.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And she comes to hang out with us all the time. And we still talk a lot. But it was a relationship that was kind of destroyed. But once we got clear about ourselves and we were able to kind of go on our path, I think other people in our family sort of saw that and said, "Wow, they can do it, so can I."
Yeah.
That's great. Hi, I love your story. I think it's great. I enjoyed getting to know you at the GLI. I've been excited to have you on this podcast. I think you've got a powerful story, and I know that you know that you've got a powerful story, and you use that in ways that enhance the things that you're passionate about and are using it in your part of the world for what you can to affect positive change.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate what you're doing with these podcasts because I think for me, being able to share these stories with others it was helpful for me to hear other people's stories and go through mm-hmm. my own healing process and see the similarities in others and how they were able to change or overcome challenges. And so I think for me, it's like kind of a giving back or paying forward and just to be able to be vulnerable and share the messiness of life and what we have to go through to get better. It's a blessing to be able to do that. And if it helps people, then that's even better.
Yeah.
I really appreciated the time, just echoing what Jackie said, taking to talk to us, and thank you for your story.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Okay. We'll keep in touch, Jared. Thanks.
Okay. Have a good one.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
We just wanted to remind you at the end of another episode that your story matters, and remember there's something meaningful in every chapter. Don't wait to share your story with us until it's finished.
You can share your story with us on our Facebook page, Healing Paths, Inc., or on our website, www.thanksforsharingpodcast.com. This podcast is solely for the purpose of information and entertainment and does not constitute therapy, nor should it replace competent professional help.
At the end of another episode, we want to remind you that nobody has time for perfection. We are pursuing progress.
And remember the prayer of the perfectionist. Help me remember I can't do it all. Help me to take things one step at a time, and that the only step I need to focus on is the next right step for me.
Help me to remember that life is a journey. Help me to be able to separate all that I am learning from all that I have to do. Help me to remember that I am not alone, that I can ask for help. Help me to strive for frequent awakenings, not mastery. I am enough. Amen.